Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Amy Littlefield, The Nation magazine's abortion access correspondent, who assesses the outcome of the presidential election and the contradiction among voters who supported both abortion rights and Donald Trump. Tamika Middleton of Women's March, who talks about the January 18th People's March in Washington, D.C. and other cities next year to protest the threats posed by a second Trump regime to civil liberties, gender equality, and democracy itself. And Tegan Blackburn and her daughter Taya Blackburn Baker, who explain why they spoke out at the November 21st Federal Energy Regulatory Commission meeting, their concern about the climate crisis and our planet's future. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The United Nations Climate Change Conference, or COP29, held in Baku, Azerbaijan this month, nearly collapsed after developing nations rejected an initial offer by wealthy countries to contribute $250 billion annually to help poorer nations cope with the increasingly catastrophic impacts of the climate crisis. But more than 30 hours after the conference was due to end, the European Union, the U.S., and other wealthy countries pledged to provide $300 billion annually into the fund by 2035, an offer that was agreed to by more than 200 nations at the climate summit. The $300 billion will go to vulnerable nations to help them respond to and recover from the effects of increasingly devastating extreme weather events while transitioning their economies toward clean energy. The amount pledged, however, falls far short of the $1.3 trillion economists say is needed to help developing countries deal with the climate crisis they have done the least to cause. At the summit, U.S. negotiators were forced to grapple with the likelihood that President-elect Donald Trump and the Republican-controlled Congress taking charge in January will withdraw from future climate talks and refuse to approve new international climate funding. Top economic advisors to President-elect Donald Trump and congressional Republicans have begun talks on making major cuts to programs for the poor, including Medicaid health insurance, food stamps, and other federal social safety net programs. Their goal is to offset the enormous cost of extending Trump's 2017 tax cuts next year that disproportionately benefits the wealthiest Americans. Among the options under discussion are the implementation of new work requirements for Medicaid recipients and program spending caps. But some Republican legislators, especially those in swing states, are fearful of a potential backlash from voters who will lose their health care coverage. Such a backlash occurred in the 2018 midterm election after Trump unsuccessfully attempted to eliminate the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, that would have taken away health insurance from millions of Americans. Bobby Kogan of the Center for American Progress maintains that while Republicans talk a lot about slashing budgets to stop waste and abuse, most of the GOP-proposed cuts achieve savings not by stopping waste, but by preventing eligible people from successfully enrolling in programs, deliberately creating red tape and unnecessary bureaucracy. A year ago, New Haven, Connecticut tenant Beatrice Caban discovered black mold in her apartment after she moved into a low-income housing complex owned by Capital Realty Group, which owns more than 18,000 units across 28 states. In the months that followed, her infant son was rushed to the hospital several times due to spreading mold in the apartment that caused the baby's lungs to become inflamed and his airways to spasm and close. Although doctors told Kaban that continuous exposure to mold can cause chronic asthma in children and adults, Capital Realty Group failed to address the mold problem. Mold in housing was only recently classified as a major threat to public health and a condition that's likely to increase as big storms linked to the climate crisis damage apartment buildings. In these Times reports that nationally, corporate landlords, often with poor maintenance records, are rapidly buying up affordable rental apartment units. By the end of 2020, corporate LLCs owned 44% of U.S. rental housing. As Capital Realty has expanded its extractive model of housing across the country, allegations of unaddressed mold problems followed. In the past 3 years, outbreaks of severe mold have been reported in Capital Realty-owned buildings from Washington, D.C. to New Orleans to Chicago. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Kamala Harris and the Democratic Party had made reproductive rights the centerpiece of their election campaign, hoping that women, particularly white women, would turn out in large numbers to vote against Donald Trump, the president responsible for the Supreme Court's ruling that overturned the 1973 Roe v. Wade High Court decision that protected women's constitutional right to abortion. In the November 5th election, ballot initiatives in 10 states gave voters a chance to weigh in on the question of keeping abortion legal in their states. In 7 of those 10 states, voters supported the right to abortion. But in a seeming contradiction, many voters who cast their ballot to keep abortion legal also voted for Trump and Republican legislators that oppose abortion rights. According to exit polls, 53% of white women across the country voted for convicted felon Donald Trump, who a court found to be liable for sexual assault, the same voting group that the Harris campaign was depending on to win the White House. Your reporter spoke with Amy Littlefield, The Nation magazine's abortion access correspondent, who examines voters' contradictory position on abortion and the Republican candidates they supported, as well as the threat posed by the incoming Trump administration and GOP-controlled Congress that's poised to further erode reproductive rights.
A couple takeaways from this election, right? One is that abortion rights are popular and voters are angry about the end of Roe v. Wade. That remains true. And when voters have a chance to vote on abortion rights in isolation from other issues, they tend to vote in favor of those rights. And yet another resounding takeaway is that that popularity of abortion rights does not translate necessarily into victory for Democrats, even when they run on the issue. And of course, Kamala Harris ran hard on abortion rights, harder than any Democratic politician, you know, presidential candidate that I've ever seen. So I think for some of those voters, clearly abortion rights were not the most important issue. The economy, of course, was the most important issue for many of them. And for many of these voters, they were convinced by, as you say, Trump's successful attempt to distance himself from the fact that he was the president responsible for the end of Roe v. Wade. I think he was slippery enough on the issue that the most diehard anti-abortion supporters saw him backtracking on the issue. And while they were a little annoyed about it, some of them even more than a little annoyed, they denounced it publicly, they were still willing to vote for him and to call for supporting him. And he was able to win over people who were pro-choice and who want to see the right to abortion, but who thought somehow Trump had carved out, you know, a middle ground on this issue, which is, of course, contrary to his record. I also want to note that, you know, lack of information may have been a part of this. The New York Times reported in May that nearly 1 in 5 voters in battleground states believe that it was President Biden who was responsible for ending the constitutional right to abortion. And this included 12% of Democrats who believe that. And so while that was before, you know, the final push and all the advertising we saw in the summer and fall, It's worth noting that a large percentage of voters are simply misinformed.
And Amy, I wanted to ask you, under a coming Trump regime, what's the likelihood that Republican and anti-abortion activists will push to ban IVF? There's also a lot of energy behind the idea of invoking a fetal personhood law at the federal level. And lastly, there is a lot of pressure within the Republican ranks to invoke the 150-year-old Comstock Act, which could end women's access to abortion medication through the mail and even ban the distribution of contraceptives. What are you most concerned about in that realm, given the fact that not only is Donald Trump in the White House, but Republicans now control the House and Senate?
Right. It's going to be really interesting to see, because some of the selections that Donald Trump has made so far, people like RFK Jr., right, are certainly not anti-abortion ideologues. And yet some of them, of course, are true believers, and some of his supporters are true believers. While Donald Trump seems to maintain a very dedicated commitment to misogyny, I'm not sure how much he personally cares about this issue, except, you know, where it curries him favor in certain corners that might be strategic. So I think the biggest threat is the 1873 Comstock Act, which, as you say, was an anti-vice law from the Victorian era that was at one point used to crack down on, you know, pornographic materials or lewd and lascivious drawings that were being sent through the mail, in addition, of course, to contraception and abortifacient devices and drugs. Anti-abortion activists have been trying to revive the Comstock Act. And in fact, it's part of Project 2025 to use this 150-year-old law to try to institute a de facto nationwide abortion ban. Because in its most stringent meaning, of course, if abortion clinics can't get the devices and the equipment they need, much less send abortion pills, as is happening right now, you know, you have doctors in blue states who are shipping abortion medication into states, including Texas. That could all potentially end if they decide to revive this 150-year-old law, which, of course, the appeal of that is that it does not require passage of any new legislation by Congress because it's already on the books. So I think we're going to see some interesting tensions emerge, actually, between, you know, true believers, anti-abortion ideologues who want to ban IVF, who do not agree with the use of contraception, and some of the, you know, strange choices Donald Trump has made for some of his cabinet selections. But I'm keeping my eye certainly on that 150-year-old law. I have never thought so much about, you know, the 1870s and the anti-vice crusade that was on about that time, which, of course, some of Trump's supporters are trying their best to resuscitate.
That was Amy Littlefield, The Nation magazine's abortion access correspondent and author of the forthcoming book titled American Crusaders, A History of the Anti-Abortion Movement Over the Last 50 Years. Find a link to her recent articles and related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. When Donald Trump surprised the nation with a narrow Electoral College election victory and popular vote loss in 2016, many among the majority of Americans who had voted against him were in a state of shock and despair. Soon a group of women from across the country began organizing what would become the largest single-day protest in U.S. history. The Women's March, as it was called, drew over 500,000 people to Washington, D.C. on January 21, 2017, to voice opposition to the threat his administration posed to reproductive, civil, and human rights. On that same day, more than 3 million people in cities across the country and around the world participated in local protests in a global show of support for the resistance movement. In the wake of Donald Trump's 2024 election victory, Women's March is again organizing a major protest they're calling the People's March on January 18th in Washington, D.C., and around the country. The nationwide action will serve as a space for supporters to build community and power, with a focus on the risks a second Trump administration will pose to civil liberties, gender rights, reproductive rights, and healthcare access. Your reporter spoke with Tamika Middleton, managing director of Women's March, who discusses nationwide organizing she and others are doing in advance of the January 18th People's March in Washington, D.C., and other cities across the U.S.
You know, as the impetus behind the first Women's March, there's really a moment where women at that time saw the role and the importance of coming together to stand up against a Trump, incoming Trump presidency, and the understanding of the repression that was to come. And so in this time, what we realized is that what we have to be doing is building a big tent and building a movement that has space for more and more people to come in. So really building a mass movement that has space for all of us and for all of our issues, all of our concerns. And so the shift this time is that we're building a coalition to plan and organize this mobilization together so that we can have a number of perspectives and issue areas. And so not only will abortion access, of course, be one major issue, but also there are organizations inside of the coalition that are looking at immigration rights, that are looking at racial justice, that are looking at economic justice, that are looking at climate justice. And so we're really trying to build a big umbrella that allows lots of people into the space and help them land not only in the political conversation, but inside of political organizations that they can continue to organize inside of even after that mobilization, because we know we'll have to continue to fight and continue to be active and continue to contend for power over the next 4 years and beyond.
One of the challenges of organizing a second march, you know, since the historic 2017 original Women's March, is that the turnout will always be compared to that enormous outpouring of opposition to Trump just as he was about to take office in 2017. How are you dealing with that problem? Because can you match the numbers? How important is that? And certainly the media, in its jaundiced way, will look at whatever numbers, if it's less than what happened in 2017, is somehow chalking it up to a failure. Those are really tough things for you as an organizer to deal with. Maybe you could just comment on some of your thoughts of all that.
Absolutely. I think it would be an unrealistic bar for us to try to, every time we turn people out, to try to meet that level, to reach the sort of massiveness that was this like spontaneous outpouring that happened in 2017. And so we are not unrealistic. We are, but what we are is strategic. And we're thinking about this not as a matter of how many people we turn out on a day, but rather how many people we bring in and then land in organizations that can continue to organize. And so what we're focusing on this time, of course, we're focusing on turnout, but we're focusing on just as much is how we build out the infrastructure for people to be absorbed into organizations through this mobilization. And that's really been our focus. That is what feels most important to us. But also the thing I want to note as well is that what we are seeing, even as we are very, you know, early in the recruitment and in the, you know, the conversation around this mobilization, is that there is a lot of energy around mobilizing in people's local communities. And so while, you know, we've not done much promotion of this mobilization, what we have seen is that we have more than 60,000 people already signed up to mobilize in their local communities and in their cities and states. And so while, you know, we are not anticipating that we will in D.C. be able to reach that number, and we don't have any we're not holding that metric as a metric of success. What we are recognizing is that more people want to get involved and are prepared to get involved where they are. And we're trying to ensure that we can help those folks find the organizations in their communities that they can plug into. And so that even when we leave January 18th, when we get to January 20th, when we get to, you know, next November, that people are still engaged and still involved, and that we don't lose the momentum and the energy that that we're seeing build at this time. And the exhaustion, I know, is so real. Like, I feel it in my own body, you know, after two decades plus of organizing, you know, the exhaustion absolutely settles in. And that is part of why, for us, the mobilization is important, because it does provide a place for new people with new energy who are just being activated to come into the movement, to begin to build their leadership, so that we can offer some release and some relief and respite for folks who have been in the movement for the long haul.
That was Tamika Middleton, Managing Director of Women's March. Learn more about the January 18th People's March in Washington, D.C. and other cities across the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Almost every month for the past 10 years, activists with a climate action group Beyond Extreme Energy, or BXE, have attended the monthly meeting of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, to raise concerns about the agency's rubber stamping of almost every methane pipeline, compressor station, and liquefied natural gas export terminal project that's come before it. At its November meeting, the five commissioners approved the equivalent of 9 coal plants' worth of carbon emissions. Although the public isn't allowed to speak at FERC's so-called public hearings, when people interrupt the proceedings, they're removed and banned from future meetings. At its November 21st hearing, a broader coalition called Unfrack FERC protested outside the commission meeting that included activists from Third Act, an organization of elders, and the Grail, a spiritually grounded women's group. 9 women dressed in sackcloth and ashes, calling themselves lamenters, walked slowly in a circle across the driveway of the FERC parking garage, wearing signs with stark black lettering, proclaiming the climate disasters they're lamenting, such as floods, droughts, biodiversity loss, and hunger. 4 individuals spoke out at the November 21st meeting, including a mother and daughter from New York, Tegan Blackburn and Taya Blackburn Baker. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who's a member of BXE, asked them why they attended the FERC meeting and their concerns about the climate crisis in the future of our planet. We hear first from 15-year-old Taya.
The environment is something I've always cared about. I was raised by parents who taught me at a young age that I should, you know, protect my planet, you know, my home, because it takes care of me, so we should take care of it back. But also on a personal level, as someone who's going to grow up in this world, as this generation, I want to take care of it, and I want to see my children take care of it and grow up in a world where we have all of this beautiful biodiversity, and we have all of these changes of seasons, and we're healthy, and we're happy, and I don't want to destroy the world that I'm going to give them. So I came down to D.C. because I want to make a difference, and I want to show people that this generation and that younger people care too, and that we care about the world that you're giving us.
When you spoke out at the FERC commissioners meeting, you said you were angry and you were terrified. You know, I work with young people, not usually as young as you, but, you know, college age and early 20s. And I'm always afraid to ask them how they feel unless they express to me how they feel, because I don't want to raise anything that is going to be more painful to them, because I'm not going to be around all that much longer. I mean, no matter how hard I try, I cannot imagine what it's like to be a 15-year-old, especially with the Trump administration coming in. I mean, I understand why you're angry. I'd like to hear more about the terrified part.
I'm scared and I'm angry that there are so many people who seem to care so little about me and about our home, and who seem so willing to self-sabotage and destroy their home, their planet, just for profit, for recognition. And so it's terrifying that some people seem to be so uneducated that they are willingly killing themselves, killing the environment that sustains them. And, you know, it's usually not their fault.
Tegan, let me ask you, why did you come down and bring your daughter to this meeting in D.C.?
Well, I came down after facilitating a meeting for the GRAIL Climate Action Group that was talking about how to help people who do care about the state of the world's climate. How do you get more involved? How do you activate? What can you do? How do you educate yourself and others? And so after that weekend in October, I was very inspired to start to take more action, because I feel like with climate change, it does seem such a big insurmountable problem that many people don't know where to start. Like, how do I start to care besides recycling or composting? I mean, there's so many other ways to get involved, but they seem like so insignificant, like these little tiny pieces of progress that you can make. But what I've come to realize as an activist over all these years is I really give some deep thought about how can I make the most change the quickest, or how can we as a society solve this problem the quickest? And the people at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission have so much power for being just five people making these decisions about, how many fossil fuel projects are we going to renew this year, and where are they going to be located, and how are we going to build up the infrastructure to transmit energy from one region to the next or not. However, they're not giving enough thought to where the energy is coming from and at what stake, like what is going to be lost if we choose to derive the energy for our grid from fossil fuels instead of from geothermal and wind and hydropower and solar and all these other wonderful up and coming technologies that work with Mother Earth, like with the planet instead of against the planet. And I feel like with going and disrupting the FERC meeting and trying to bring some more attention to the people in the room and to the media, that like this is where the big change can be taking place. And if we don't organize like more governmental laws and regulations, like we need climate mandates, like clean energy mandates, because just leaving it up to people to make decisions about what kind of car they buy or how they're going to insulate their house or not is not going to be enough for how much time we have left, which is not much.
That was Tegan Blackburn and her daughter Taya Blackburn Baker, who participated in a protest action at the monthly meeting of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Learn more about Beyond Extreme Energy and other climate action groups by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFI in Ithaca, New York, KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, KKRN in Round Mountain, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.